Well, greetings again, brethren. It's very good to see you. I wanted to continue today with the messages I've been giving about discerning the signs of the times, and this should conclude it. I will say, God willing, this will be the conclusion. I don't know what might happen in the course of this if I get inspired to talk about something, and at least I hope it's inspired. Then it might continue on longer, but I'm going to try to complete this today. I think that that this will be the end of this, at least for the moment, and that will be that'll wrap this up for now. So anyway, one thing I wanted to mention though was something I just received, and you probably received this too. How many of you got the letter from the President Vic Kubik that just came, and maybe you read that? But I want to. If you all didn't, I'm going to read a paragraph out of this that I found remarkable because I didn't, I don't know, I somehow missed this. But he said, a few years ago, Pew Research Center, an independent research group, conducted a national study and asked Americans what they thought life would be like by 2050. The result, mirroring events of today, almost 60% believe that another world war would take place before 2050. Over half believe that a nuclear attack on the United States will take place. And you know, that's understandable. But this one really floored me. It says, and perhaps most interestingly of all, over 40% of Americans surveyed believe that by 2050, Jesus Christ will have returned to earth. 40% of Americans, just a few years ago, believed that by 2050, Jesus Christ will have returned to the earth. That's awesome that they, you know, but of course, if you're looking at the world scene, you think it's got to be the case. And we need to remember that that just reminds us also that a huge number of Americans are, you know, believe in the Bible, believe in Christianity. Now, exactly what they believe in regards to that, you know, it may be not what we believe. I noticed that Mr. Kubik here a little bit later mentions that that the respondents to the Pew Research were right, that Jesus is the one who will be returning to restore this earth. And I'd say that statement is correct, except on the end of it, I wouldn't say exactly that for everybody, because there's probably a lot of people who think Jesus will restore the earth, but a lot of people would just think that Jesus is coming to rapture away believers and take them to heaven, and everybody else will burn in hell, there's not going to be any rejuvenation of the earth. They don't understand the kingdom message that we teach. So they do believe Jesus is coming to save people, but they don't understand the whole plan of God as far as bringing the rest of humanity into a knowledge of the truth and converting the world and bringing everybody into relationship with God. Now, there's a lot of people who kind of do get that a little bit. They understand the idea of Jesus' reign for 1,000 years, but they don't understand anything about the second resurrection or the fact that, you know, everybody's going to have this opportunity for salvation. They think that's only, you know, limited pretty much to right now for everybody else. And if you don't go along with that, you're toast. And of course, we know the truth, and we're very thankful for that. Well, brethren, there's a lot to be looking at in the world today to tell us that Jesus Christ's return is very near. And as I've covered in these previous messages, you know, there were signs for Jesus' first coming that people should have been paying attention to. And, you know, Jesus criticized them for being able to know the signs of the weather that indicate what kind of weather it's going to be by what color the sky was at what time of day. And yet they couldn't discern the signs of the times. They should have been able to do that then. And in the context of his second coming, they should be able to do it again, because there are many signs that he gave of his second coming. And of course, we heard in our, you know, former association, as it was going through apostasy, it started to say things like, you know, Jesus' return, we don't have a clue when it would be. It could be five years, it could be 500 years. And that is just absolute nonsense. There are many indications in the Bible that show Jesus' return is very near. Right now, we have very general indicators of it. But I do think we can say safely that we're in the last generation, and it can't be a great number of decades away, I think, before everybody will have died off from when end-time prophecy was opened up. And that does not fit with the picture of what is revealed in Scripture, that Scripture gives us these indications of things that are happening. And when we see these things begin to happen, we can look up and know that our redemption draws near. And it does. It certainly does. It's not forever far away. It is very soon. But then, of course, I asked the question, could Jesus return tomorrow? And the answer to that is no, because you have to have the tribulation day of the Lord. And that takes time. Now, some people say, well, the Jesus comes before that, you know, with the rapture before that, a pre-tribulation rapture. And so that could happen at any time. Well, of course, we don't believe that. And I think that's a false doctrine. It's not what the Bible teaches, that the church is going to be raptured away before the tribulation and day of the Lord. Of course, any of us could die before the tribulation and day of the Lord. Any of us could meet our Maker in a moment, because we have no assurance of life going on for any length of time. And even though we do have God's promises to protect us and help us, but one way He might do that is by extracting us prematurely through death. We think of death as a curse, but in that case, death is a blessing. And we would be very thankful for it, because we would actually, in that sense, time travel to the return of Christ, which would be an awesome thing. But it's sad for those left behind who would miss the people that are gone. So we certainly don't wish for that in that sense, because we want to be able to continue with the work that God's given us to do now and care for those that that we need to be caring for at this time. But then I ask the question, and then I'll get back to this now, could the tribulation start tomorrow? And that's the message that I covered the last time. And I'll just mention very briefly here the points that I had said before. And I said a lot of people think that it could, because they think that you would have the beast appear overnight, the tribulation would immediately start. But that is not really so either, because a number of things have to happen. And the first point I covered on that, and I covered in a very lengthy manner, because we went through Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, these mentions of all the curses that would come on in sort of increasing fashion, was number one, there was the further decline of modern Israel. We're already on the decline side of where a rise and fall of great powers, we're on the decline side, but we still are way up there. So, looking in comparison to the rest of the world, we are in a very high position still. But there are things that could bring us down. And many natural disasters could bring us down. I guess, saw the update from Mr. Barnett about the Yellowstone caldera. If that volcano goes, that would be absolute devastation. But it could go in different degrees. I mean, there's not a certainty of what measure of eruption that would have if it happened. So, I mean, it could happen in a very limited scale and not cause as much damage. But if it happened, a major Plinian eruption with that would end up blanketing the entire western United States in ash, this would be unbelievable devastation, and it would really bring America down. Economically, that would be the main factor too, because you would have just being able trying to deal with that catastrophe, especially if that was not the only catastrophe. If you have a couple catastrophes at once, that would, I think, strain us beyond the breaking point as far as maintaining the veneer of civilization that we have. That would go away, and that would be pretty quickly, it would bring things down. However, the pattern shown in the Bible is that there is it doesn't happen instantly, the taking down the nation of Israel. It's a process, a sort of a gradual process. I'm sure there are major events in that, but God gives people time to repent. He gives people time to see the signs and to change and to do the right. And if they don't, then worse things come. And that's what we've seen before, and I think that's what we will see again. And we've already seen some of that. I mean, I think we've had some warnings, but I think the warnings are going to escalate greatly in the times not far ahead of us. Well, then I went on, number two, to mention an Arab confederation allied with Germany, because I mentioned Psalm 83 and showed all these various Middle Eastern Arab peoples that were part of this confederation. And then it said at the end of that, Assyria is joined with them. And so you had Germany, in this sense, allied, Germany will be allied with this Islamic confederation against Israel. And I said there was a precedent for that back even at the time of Hitler. You had the Hitler Mussolini axis was actually allied with some of the Muslim leaders to eradicate the Jews. I mean, they were in partnership in that sense, and I think we will see some of that again. And one thing I want to add to that, by the way, because I mentioned that this would precede the what you see in the Bible about the actions of the king of the south attacking the king of the north, which I'll mention here in a minute. Again, that's one of my points, actually. But at some point, you have this king of the south will push at the king of the north, will attack the king of the north. And a lot of people are very critical of identifying this confederation. I think there is probably that we should identify this confederation with this king of the south that's coming. And I think this king of the south is probably a Muslim confederation. I think probably centered in Egypt, like the ancient king of the south was in Egypt. And people don't see how that could be. But as I mentioned, Egypt is actually the largest concentration of Arabs. So when the Bible talks about the Ishmaelites being part of this, that would seem to definitely involve Saudi Arabia as well as Egypt. Egypt, the biggest Arab state of all. And in that sense, you think, well, wait a minute. What is the time frame for this? What is the time frame for this Arab confederation? Is this at the very end? And I would say, no, it's not at the very end. And why would I say that? Because you have the king of the south is going to attack the king of the north. And if Assyria is a major component of that king of the north, if Assyria is a major component of Europe, then, and you think, well, this king of the south is going to attack the king of the north, is going to attack Europe, then this confederation where you have this Islamic grouping that is in partnership with Assyria has to come before that. It has to come before that attack. So in other words, before that, they're together. And at some point, that alliance breaks apart. And what I want us to see about that in this point is that this point is something early then to be looking for, because this would come before that coming attack. You know, we might be thinking, oh, we're going to have, we need to be looking for this attack that the South is going to launch at the North, and maybe some terrorist acts it could be. But before that, you need to have this this Arab confederation in alliance with Europe. Before that. So that's the thing to be looking at first. Or instead of looking immediately for this this attack that's going to bring about these final events, we need to have, before that, we need to have them actually together. And they've been sort of together. I mean, Germany has given a lot of support to some of these Muslim things, and especially against Israeli interests. Although, supposedly, Germany is an ally of Israel. And in some respects, I guess they are, even though you've got a disparity among the populace there. So we really need to be understanding that that's going to come about. We need to be looking for that. Well, the number three thing I gave was a powerful Europe with an ascendant church and a subject USA and Britain. And as I mentioned, Revelation 17 and 18 shows this religious power ruling over the political power, as well as a commercial power in chapter 18. Babylon is both. It is both a religious political power and it is an economic power in the world. And it parallels ancient Tyre in Ezekiel 27, this great ship of state, which actually involves other nations such as America and Britain. It involves the Israelite countries, as it mentions in Ezekiel 27, that Israel and Judah were the traitors of this system. That was true in ancient times. It's going to be true in the end time, that America and Judah are traitors in this Babylonian marketplace, and that there is a reliance on this Babylonian marketplace for the merchants of the earth. And that's very clear from Revelation 18. You can see that stated there. And I did say that, you know, you have sort of this a secularist bent among the Europeans, but they have a very strong loyalty to the Catholic tradition. And I think I mentioned after church last time, I think that there's sort of the thing about, you know, they darken the doors there at important times. They're was their bread, wed, and dead. You know, they're born, the christening, and then when they, there might be another one in there. Of course, when they get married and then for their funerals, this is all very much tied to the Catholic Church. But so is just a general loyalty to that system. And I think when we see, as I did mention before, when we start seeing the miracles that are prophesied in the Bible coming from this false system, we will see a lot more fervor and loyalty directed toward this system. And I don't know if I mentioned this. Maybe I did. I can't remember. But one thing also I can see happening is a backlash against the rise of Islam in Europe that would prompt a greater devotion toward Roman Catholicism as a counterweight against that growing tide of Islamist terrorism and just taking over various aspects of society and the fragmenting of culture there. There's a lot of people that are very much wanting to preserve European culture in the face of this ingress of Islamist civilization. They do not want that. And I think you'll see more of a backlash against that as we go. And I do remember that Mr. Barnett also sent me an article about how there was a growing Christianity in France, even. France, we think of as a very secular country, and yet they had that growing there. And again, I bet it's, you know, a great reason for that is this backlash against the growing Islamist culture there. And maybe a backlash even against some of the secularism that's come, because that's been in conflict with the traditional European history. Something I did not say on that, Mark, and I will mention it now. I did mention how ancient Israel and ancient Judah had become really subservient to these great empires of Assyria and Babylon and later Rome before they were actually taken over by those empires. And then when they were taken over by them, they basically were incorporated into these, and it's when they tried to get out of their relationship with these great empires that they were squashed. And I do see that could happen. Well, again, you see Britain right now is a part of the European Union, and bad things may come when it wants to extricate itself from that system. And America may become more tightly integrated into that European system before it wants to get out of it too. It may not. I don't know how that's going to go. I don't want to be dogmatic about that. But I would not be surprised. We've already signed integration treaties with Europe. I just don't know what the progress of those are. I know that the current leadership of the country would probably love us to be made part of a European socialist utopia. And I don't see, even though we'll probably have some backlash against that, it's just that this whole progressive movement keeps driving us in that direction, and I would not be surprised if we become more entangled with that system as we go. One thing that we see in the Bible is God's warning to Israel about trusting in its, quote, lovers, and what it's talking about is its allies, meaning it's going to these other nations as if it's got some kind of, infidelity, marital infidelity involved in that. Because, of course, they're supposed to be married to God, but yet there is an infidelity of the nation when it seeks these other, quote, lovers. And some of that is in the sense of other gods. You know, God talks about Israel playing the harlot with other gods. But also it involves these other political powers are looked on at, God looks at them as the nation's lovers, because they are putting their trust and reliance on these other political powers and not on God. And you'll find that, I'll just give you some references, in Jeremiah 3 and 4 and 22, God tells them this. He says this in Ezekiel 16 and Ezekiel 23, and he says it in Hosea 2, how they're going and trying to, you know, get help from these lovers. But what God says is that these lovers are going to turn on them. And that, if we think about it in context of today, we try to put all this reliance on these allies, such as Europe, and in the end, they end up turning on us. And that is going to happen, brethren. That is what the Bible prophesies will happen. It is definitely going to happen. That brings us to number four. So now we'll continue on here. Number four, I have here an agreement between Europe and Israel. An agreement between Europe and Israel. I'd like us to turn over to Daniel chapter 11. You know, Dr. Housel's been going through the book of Daniel. I'm going to sneak here to the back and mention a few things about what Daniel prophesied, because it's integral to what I'm covering here. I need to hit this here to show what we're talking about. Number, again, the point being agreement between Europe and Israel. What am I talking about? Well, I'd like us to look here at Daniel 11, because in this chapter we have, and maybe, I'm sure this will be covered later in more depth, but just to mention this, you have here this whole history of kings of the north and kings of the south that are successor kings to Alexander the Great. Basically, Alexander's empire was split into four parts, and two of those parts are north and south of the land of Israel, of where Judah was at that time. And when you look through here, you can actually follow, it mentions the king of the north does this, the king of the south does this, the king of the north does this, the king of the south does this. And it keeps referring to king of the north and south. But the actual people that are occupying those offices changes through the prophecy, because there's a succession of kings that are being talked about. This isn't all talking about the same king of the north, king of the south. It's going through a progression, and you're going from one to the other. And then we get to a point in the prophecy where it's very obvious, following along in history, that we're talking about the time of a king, evil king, called Antiochus the IV, a Seleucid ruler of the north, that is, of Greek Syria. He's also called Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means God manifest, because he was really something, a megalomaniac who believed he was that. He was the God manifest, and of course he was not that, but so maybe the God of this world, I suppose. You could say he was that. That's probably true, but he was certainly not the true God manifest. But anyway, when we come down to this, we can read here, starting in verse, we'll read in verse 21. Let's look here. It says, "In his place shall arise a vile person." And that's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, as we follow along here. "To whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With force of a flood they shall be swept away before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant." And that prince of the covenant is actually talking about the leader of the Jewish religion, which was the high priest at that time, who would be swept away. Because they were actually appointing the high priests at that time. The Syrians were telling them who could be high priest. "And after the league is made with him," and that's the thing I want us to key in right here. After the league is made with him, after the Jews made a pact or agreement with Antiochus Epiphanes, it says, "He shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people." Now we're going to see what he does here. "He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds." And I think that's very interesting, because it sounds like he's coming in as a kind of a Robin Hood pretender. Take from the rich, give to the poor. Socialist redistributionists, maybe that's what we're talking about here. It looks like sort of he's going to help out the Jews. But it says he acts deceitfully. So there seems to be some agreement that they made with Antiochus. There was some kind of a deal that gave, you know, him greater access to the nation, but yet it really just set him in a position to be able to rule over the nation more directly and powerfully, and actually bring a lot of persecution on the Jews. He eventually did here. "He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army," and he did. "And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him." And I don't want to go into all the details of this. We'll talk about this later. We're actually covered through Daniel 11. And those who you know, many are going to fall down slain, verse 26. And I'm going to skip here to verse 28. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart will be moved against the holy covenant, and he shall do damage and return to his own land. There was some damage that he did against the Jews there. And at the appointed time, he will return and go toward the south, but it won't be like the former or latter. For ships from Cyprus, it says, but actually this is Kittim, which means the western lands. And really we're talking about Rome here. Will come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he's going to really do a wallop on the Jewish nation there, is what it was talking about. So he will return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. He would give special privilege to those who compromised the truth and went along with his Hellenization process, Greekizing, basically, of the nation. And forces will be mustered by him, in verse 31, and they will defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they will take away the daily sacrifice and place there the abomination of desolation. And those who do wickedly against the covenant, he will corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God will be strong and carry out great exploits. Now, what I want us to notice here is, you hold your place right there and flip over to Matthew really quickly. Hold your place there in Daniel 11. And flip over to Matthew 24. In Matthew 24 and verse 15. And Jesus says that. Now, Jesus lived, you know, this was 100 or about almost 200 years after that episode with Antiochus that was prophesied there. Jesus said in Matthew 24:15, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. And this is something we need to know, brethren. Some people say, well, these are esoteric matters. Jesus said, you need to know this. You need to understand what we're talking about here. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and et cetera. He goes on about people need to flee. But the key is, when you see the abomination spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, then let those in Judea flee. So this is something that would happen in the future. Flip back to Daniel 11. What I want us to understand about this prophecy, and it's very important that we grasp this here for a second. As we read through Daniel 11, we read this about the abomination of desolation in Daniel 11 and verse 31. We just read that there would be this abomination of desolation. And we can trace the history and know that this happened at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, if you continue reading this prophecy, it mentions it's the end time and you have all these events happening up through the end of the chapter, the beginning of the next chapter, but you do not have a repeat of the abomination of desolation. This is what I want us to understand. This is kind of a complicated point that I'm about to make, so I need maybe just think about this take a step back and think about this in terms of what you might expect. You might expect that you've got this mention of the abomination of desolation, then the prophecy continues up to the future, and you would have this mention of an abomination of desolation again. But there is no mention of it again in this context. Therefore, what we need to understand is this passage in Daniel 11:31 is a dual prophecy. It is referring to Antiochus Epiphanes, no doubt. But it is also referring, according to Jesus, to the future. Now, if that is true, then it means that much of what you see in the surrounding verses also applies to the end time, not just the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Otherwise, it really makes no sense if you think about what I'm saying here. In other words, the only way that you get this abomination of desolation in verse 31, that this is something future as opposed to something that only happened in the past, is if all these mentions about the king of the north and south here have also some relation to the end time. I think that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean everything is going to be exactly fulfilled, but there is correspondence between the surrounding verses here of verse 31 to the end time, not just the abomination. Because the abomination is, says, it's, what does it say? It says in verse 31 that they and forces will be mustered by him, and they will defile the sanctuary fortress, and they will take away the daily sacrifice placed there, the abomination of desolation. So this was something that was done under Antiochus, but it's not only done by him. It's done by the end time ruler in his context. And in that case, we can see very clearly that Antiochus was very much a type of the end time ruler, and much that he did will be paralleled by this end time ruler. And notice one thing that he did, and we just read about it, was that he made a deal. He made some kind of an agreement with the Israelite leaders, the Jewish leaders of that time. And then he broke it. He broke that deal. So he broke the agreement that he made with them. Well, if that's true, then what are we talking about? I think this has to do with something we read in Daniel 9, and I would like us to look over back over here. In Daniel 9, this is the 70 weeks prophecy. And there's a lot to cover in the 70 weeks prophecy, and I don't want to go through all of it. But one thing I want to show you is something that is a bit of a disagreement that many people have about these verses here. It says in verse 26, and after the 62 weeks, Messiah will be cut off, and that brings us to the time that Jesus died. But not for himself, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, who was that? That was not the same as Messiah, the prince that was just mentioned. The prince of the people who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, it was the Romans that destroyed the city and the sanctuary. And that did happen after Jesus died. You had, in 70 AD, Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple was ransacked and razed to the ground. It says, the end of it shall be with a flood. And, of course, that's a symbol of an invasion of armies. You find in other verses, until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Now, you're talking about a desolation after, being invaded. That very much ties to the symbol of the abomination of desolation, because that's the abomination of desolation would lead to that. Well, there was a type of the abomination in that sense in the Roman invasion, but it wasn't the ultimate abomination of desolation that was coming. Then it says in verse 27, and here is where you get into the real conundrum, verse 27, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will bring an end to sacrifice and offering. I'll just read the rest here. And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate or on the desolator, other versions have. Which makes a lot of sense there. But I want us to notice this in verse 27 at the beginning. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. Well, one traditional way that this has been explained, and we have explained it this way in our literature in the past, and that is that this is talking about Jesus confirming the new covenant for a 7-year period. And then it says in the middle of the week, he will bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And the idea is that in the middle of the week, he dies, which brings an end to sacrifices because he was one sacrifice for sins forever. But there's a little bit of something strange about that, because if you notice in verse 26, it says Messiah is cut off in the beginning of verse 26, and then it jumps to the Roman destruction of Jerusalem, where it says that the city is destroyed. And then by this understanding that I just mentioned, you would have to jump then back in time to the to Christ dying in the middle of the week, and that's talking about to Christ confirming the covenant, his ministry. See what I'm saying here? So what we would have is in the beginning of verse 26, you're talking about Christ dying. Then at the end of verse 26, you're talking about Jerusalem destroyed. Then at the beginning of verse 27, you would be talking about Christ's ministry and Christ dying. And then in the end of verse 27, you're talking about Jerusalem destroyed, the abomination of desolation again. So it's sort of A-B-A-B. I mean, that's the argument, that we're actually jumping back and forth here, that that's who we're talking about. Because notice it says in verse 27, and then he shall confirm a covenant. Well, the previous verse did mention two people. Verse 26, after 62 weeks, Messiah will be cut off. That was Christ. But then it says, and the people of the prince who is to come, that's the other guy, the bad guy. So when it says, then he will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week in verse 27, which one of those is the he? Is it the Messiah, or is it the prince who is to come who would destroy the city? Now, that's a question. Now, we have come out in support that it's the Messiah, although we've also written other things on here that this is not really fully determinative. And I would say that, I don't think it's a clear point. My own leaning, I would just say, is that the one who is confirming a covenant with many for 1 week is not the Messiah in this case, that it actually is the prince who is to come. Because when it says he will bring an end to sacrifice and offering, actually, Jesus did not do that when he died. Now, in a sense, he did, because the need for it was gone. But sacrifice and offering still continued for 40 more years. Even his disciples, even Christ's disciples were still bringing offerings to the temple and going through, with sacrifices and offerings. So it doesn't make sense to me that is talking about the Messiah's death. Now, can it be? Yes. I'm not going to say maybe it is. But I actually think it makes a lot of sense that what verse 27 is talking about is not Jesus confirming the new covenant, which Jesus, by the way, didn't even introduce really the new covenant until the end of his ministry when he said, this is the blood of the new covenant, which is given for you. That didn't come up till the end of his ministry. So I don't think this idea of he confirms the covenant for 1 week and dies in the middle of it to bring an end to sacrifices. What I think this is probably talking about is that the beast power, the Roman power that we were just talking about in its end time person, the final dictator, will confirm a covenant, a pact, make an agreement with the leadership of Israel for 7 years, a 7-year agreement. And in the middle of that, 3.5 years into it, he will break the agreement. So that then you have another 3.5 years, which is the time of the tribulation and day of the Lord, the last 3.5 years. But that, and so that's what, because it says that in the middle of the week he brings an end to sacrifice and offerings. And we know that sacrifices cease 3.5 years before Christ's return. We know that from the other prophecies. And I think this is exactly parallel to other prophecies about sacrifices being cut off 1,290 days before Daniel's resurrection. Now, I'm going to say this is dogmatic, but I think it makes a lot of sense. Now, what I want us to think about this, the reason I'm giving this as a point, is that if this is true, if that scenario is true, then what it would mean is that you couldn't have the tribulation start tomorrow, because you'd actually have to have this agreement 3.5 years before the tribulation itself starts. You see what I'm saying? In other words, you couldn't just jump, unless it was not clear what this agreement was and if the agreement had already been made. But I think it wouldn't be here unless we would be able to determine that. My guess is that there's going to be some agreement made between the beast power and the Israelites. Maybe the Jewish people, maybe the other Israelite nations, the modern Israelite nations. There's going to be some kind of 7-year agreement made. And in the middle of that, 3.5 years, and part of that agreement will probably involve the reinstitution of sacrifices. It would allow that. Maybe it would be some kind of an agreement that looks like they're going along with the Jews, which might, by the way, prompt a terrible reaction from the Muslim world against the European power. That could be the thing that causes them to launch their attack. But they don't need that as a cause. There's lots of reasons they would do that. They already are claiming they want to do that. I'll talk about that here in a minute when we get to that. So basically, if this is true, then you would not have immediately a jump into the tribulation. You would have 3.5 years before the tribulation some sort of an agreement to be looking for. Now, I don't want to say it dogmatically, so we're looking for something that never comes. But it's something to be thinking about and aware of, because we may need to see that 3.5 years before the tribulation would begin. So again, that in my mind, that's something to be looking for. Certainly, as we saw in the parallel in Daniel 11 anyway, remember Antiochus Epiphanes made such a deal with the Jewish leadership and broke it. And that was the pattern of that false ruler who set up the abomination of desolation. So even without that, that would be something to be looking for, that this final ruler would do, this vile person who will rise up and take over if he's in the same kind of a position. Turn over also to Isaiah 28, if you will. Isaiah 28. And this may have something to do with this. And I'll read you the note that I put in the Bible reading program about this. But in Isaiah 28, there's a message here. And this is in, we'll look at verses 15, for instance. God says, well, let's back up to verse 14. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, you scornful men who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Now, this prophecy applied to Isaiah's day, but I think there's, you know, clear indications in here that this is also an end-time prophecy. So it says, hear the word of the Lord, you scornful men who rule this people who are in Jerusalem, because you have said, we have made a covenant with death and with Sheol, the grave, we're in agreement. When the overflowing scourge passes through, it will not come to us, for we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood we have hidden ourselves. Well, there is in Daniel 11, by the way, a prophecy of a sweeping over by the beast power. And it's interesting to me that it says, you know, that he will overflow, you know, and pass through. And here it's saying, when the overflowing scourge passes through, it will not come to us. For we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood we have hidden ourselves. And God says it's not going to work out, because it says in verse 18, your covenant with death will be annulled, and your agreement with Sheol, the grave, will not stand. When the overflowing scourge passes through, then you will be trampled down by it. For as often as it goes out, it will take you. For morning by morning it will pass over, and by day and by night it will be a terror. Just to understand the report. This is going to be really bad for them. And I wrote on this in the Bible reading program some years ago. I noted that Isaiah mentions Jerusalem's leaders making a covenant with death or agreement with Sheol, the grave. And this is from Bible Reader's Companion, says the phrase simply means that the people of Israel or Judah thought they had an agreement worked out by which they could avoid death. But God will soon annul that and strike his people with judgment. In Isaiah's day, I noted perhaps this applied to the nation's agreement with Egypt or Babylon to defend against Assyria. Yet because some of this passage apparently refers to the end time, the covenant with death may as well. In that context, it could refer to an Israeli pact or treaty with Europe that may initially preserve the Jewish state, an agreement such as that made with Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century B.C., and later with the Romans. None of these agreements has preserved the people of the Holy Land, and neither would any made in the end time. And that, I think, is probably what will occur. Let me move on here to move along to these other points here. Number five, I can't believe I only made it through the next point. But number five, temple worship reinstituted. It goes along with this, of course, temple worship reinstituted. Daniel 12 talks about the fact that sacrifices are going to be cut off. If we look back at Daniel 12, you know, we see that directly mentioned where it says in verse 11, and from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, there's debate about whether that should be sacrificed, but we've talked about this before, that the weight of evidence is that this is really talking about daily sacrifices is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days, so that you will have a cutting off of sacrifices in the end time, which means, what do we need to be looking for? We need to be looking for them to even exist, to be cut off. You know, they're not going to be cut off unless they're in place first, unless they're actually happening. So they need to actually go away. And then Daniel 9 also mentions that we just saw, where it says, he will cause the sacrifice and offering to cease. If that is talking about the end time, which I believe it is, then definitely that is a specific reference to actual sacrifices being cut off. And so you would have to have those reinstituted. Now, along with this, I will just give you as a reference 2 Thessalonians 2, which talks about the man of sin of the end time who will sit in the temple of God showing that he is God. Now, that means there has to be, or unto the temple of God, it could actually say. It doesn't have to be right inside of it. But he's going to set himself up as God in opposition to the true God. And there is a reference there to the temple, and that will be in the end time. But as I've mentioned before, we've covered this before, that temple of the end time does not need to be a complete temple. It could just be a temple that they're working on. But that there could be an altar already set up that they would be performing sacrifices on. Just like if you look at, and I'll give you this as a reference to look at in Ezra 3. Ezra 3, 1 through 6. When they came back to build the second temple, they actually instituted the they set the altar on its basis and started doing sacrifices before the foundation of the temple was laid. So they were already doing sacrifices. They had a sacrificial system going before they actually laid out the temple itself. But they had the sanctuary area laid out. There was a designated sanctuary area, even though they had not actually laid the foundation of it. And so you would expect that in the end time. You wouldn't just have an altar set up in Jerusalem out of the context of rebuilding the temple. It would have to be in context of rebuilding the temple, but that doesn't mean the temple has to be rebuilt. And it doesn't have to be rebuilt for you to say there's this guy who sits unto the temple of God, calling him, you know, that it's, you know, claiming to be God, or you know, at least in effect claiming to be God. There doesn't have to be actually a fully formed and functioning building. It could just be that they're building it in the process of it, and he's going to take over that area and the worship there and declare himself divine. We find also a reference to that in Daniel 8. I'll just give you as a reference in Daniel 8. Verses 11 through 13, it talks about the sanctuary area that being part of this, not just with the abomination of desolation. So there has to be a sanctuary area, a holy place of the end time. And verse 17 of Daniel 8 says that the prophecy is for the end time. Makes it very clear that that is an end time prophecy. And on that, I will mention that, you know, I was in Israel, I've been in there a couple times, but when I was back, I was there in 1998. They were, you know, in this process where they were purifying the priesthood and they with the red heifer. And of course, you had to have these children who were not born in a hospital because they had to be away from where death was, and they were in the process of creating a new priesthood, and they had to be all these ceremonial rules, and they had to have the sacrifice of the red heifer for purification to be able to be that priesthood. And they said at that time that you would be able to have a serving priesthood within 10 years, and that was in 1998. So I assume that, you know, by 2008 you'd have been able to have that. It's been 16 years now. So you apparently have enough people that could be doing this service now. And they've been building many of the implements. They just created the anointing oil for the new temple service. So we can very well see these things come about and happen. Let me just give you point number six very quickly, because we've already covered a little bit about it. Number six is the south versus the north. The south versus the north. And The verse I have here is Daniel 11:40. Daniel 11:40. And if you look at Daniel 11:40, it says, "At the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him, the king of the north, and the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and mighty ships and enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through." Verse 41, he will also enter the glorious land, the holy land. There's going to be an invasion of Israel at that time. But what I want us to notice is that there is a ramming by the king of the south against the king of the north. And as I mentioned a while ago, if Europe enters into some kind of a peace agreement with the Jewish people, you could see that being a cause to break the alliance that will have existed. Remember, an alliance between the Muslims and Germany from Psalm 83 needs to be broken to create when this this ramming of the south against the north happens. And so that may be the cause, but it doesn't have to be the cause. The southern power has, you know, if it's very much of an Islamic bent, it has much against a European Christendom. And in fact, I don't know if you've seen this, but ISIS has made many claims and vows to conquer Rome. That's what they want to do. And they want to destroy the Vatican. They want to conquer Rome. They believe that is the, you know, bastion of the West. They want to take it over. And so you have that motivation that's already there. That could come. But I don't think we, like I said, we'll see that instantly, because I think we need to see some more partnership between Germany and this Islamic power before we would see this episode that's mentioned in Daniel 11:40. Number seven is a very sort of a simple point, is a period of peace and prosperity. A period of peace and prosperity. And I will reference for you 1 Thessalonians. Actually, go ahead and turn over there. 1 Thessalonians 5:3. 1 Thessalonians 5:3. It says that, and this is where, you know, Paul was giving certain indications about what it would be like in the end time. But he said in 1 Thessalonians 5:3, sorry, I'm in Timothy. I thought it was the first Thessalonians. Okay. He says, "For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape." And of course, Jesus compared these end time events to labor pains that would come on a woman. Increasing frequency and intensity. And they're going to think everything's hunky-dory when they say peace and safety. Maybe they don't even really think it's hunky-dory, but they have to say that. Everything's fine, no problems. You know, it's like when they say, this is not terrorist-related, don't get too jumpy, or everything's just continued on as it always has, everything is no problem. Peace and safety, then the bad stuff happens. And I think we can see this with the whole appeasement process, the way our politics are. You know, this happened at the time of Hitler. We have peace in our time, as was announced by Neville Chamberlain right before World War II broke out. And we'll see that again, I have no doubt. We see it right now. All this stuff with Iran, making all these compromises. Everything's fine. They don't want nuclear weapons. There's no problem here. And we've stopped them from the development of that anyway with what we've done. We don't need to increase our sanctions. It's all going to be okay. Peace and safety. When they say that, look out. I'd say that's just a general principle, by the way, when they say that. But this is talking about an end-time context, and I think we'll really see that in an end-time context. And finally, my last point, I will give it to you here. And I was prepared to go into this in-depth, but I won't, because I really do want to finish this series right now. And maybe I will give this at a different time, just going through this as a major prophecy. But for right now, I'll just reference it. And that is number eight, alignment of Eastern nations. An alignment of Eastern nations. You know, we see in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And by the way, if you really want to know what I probably would have covered anyway, you can do this on your own. Go to the UCG Bible Commentary, formerly Bible Reading Program, and go to Ezekiel 38 and 39 and look at the comments there to find out who makes up this great confederation of Gog and Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. I'll just say blatantly right now what we're talking about are the Chinese, the Russians, the central Turkish powers, the Istani states, the Turkestan, you know, all those states in there. Pakistan even is in that. All these states there. Indochina. Gomer is mentioned, by the way. And Gomer, as part of that power that's mentioned there, is actually the Khmer. You know, you probably in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge, they were named after the Khmer because that used to be the Khmer Empire. That whole, you see the civilization of Angkor Wat Temple, all of that entire Southeast Asia there was the Khmer Empire, which is named after Gomer in the Bible. These are sons of Japheth, who was the father of all the Asian nations. And Togarma, you know, is mentioned there, and he was one of the probably Central Turkic people that ended up over in Siberia. All of this is talking about a vast, and the Mongols, by the way. Magog is probably tied to the Moguls and the Mongols. And all of these vast hordes of Eurasia are grouped into this. And another thing that is mentioned there is that another grouping that's mentioned there is Persia, and that's the Iranians, by the way. So Iran is in this mix as well, and some in Iraq, by the way. Iraq is heavily Shiite in its populace, even though you've got this Sunni power that's running around right now, growing. And you've also got in Ezekiel 38, it mentions, it looks like, Ethiopia and Put, which would be basically the African peninsula, typically thought to be. However, that's not what it probably is, because in ancient times, there was an eastern and western Kush. Like if you go to the Hindu Kush mountains, you're moving into India. So you've got the black peoples, the black and brown peoples of Africa, but you've also got the black and brown peoples of India. And actually in Ezekiel 38 and 39, where it's talking about Ethiopia and Put, or Kush and Put, it's really probably talking about the people of India, the Indian subcontinent. So that what that's talking about in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is a vast Eurasian power. And this, the timing for this seems to be after Christ's return, not long after Christ's return, is the time for this power to strike. However, this power probably will have come about before that. And especially when we see in Revelation 16, I'll just give you as a reference, Revelation 16, you're going to have kings of the east that are marching down to Armageddon to face the European powers first, and then they're both going to go against Christ. But you have a grouping of kings of the east, and that typically at that time would have thought, the thought would have been beyond the Euphrates to the east. And indeed, that's what all these nations were, to the north and to the east. That's this whole Eurasian conglomerate from Russia all the way over to China and Indochina. That seems like what we're talking about here. And an interesting thing is to note in Ezekiel 27, by the way, in Ezekiel 27, where we talked about Tyre, this end-time Babylon, these various nations, some of them that are mentioned in Ezekiel 38 and 39, are also in that trading system. So they seem to be involved in that end-time trading system before they too break away from it and are opposed to it and an enemy of it, as we see in Revelation 16, where they're coming and against these Eurasian powers. And I will just mention about this, by the way, that Mr. Barnett sent me last week a note. I think it was last week. A few weeks ago. That Putin had started this Eurasian economic community. You have the European community, but he's now started this Eurasian economic community. He's trying to get all these Eastern powers to join it. I just found this very remarkable. They already have what's called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. And brethren, it reads like the list in Ezekiel 38, 39. All these nations that are listed there are part of this massive cooperation group that is trying to build its ties and grow its military alliances along with its economic ties now and bringing them together cohesively under this Eurasian economic community. So I think we're seeing the groundwork laid for all this. And again, I mentioned this as things to look for. But we'll see these things coming together more. Well, that's all I have. I do want to wrap it up with that. And I want us to just remember, brethren, the return of Jesus Christ is not far away. He is coming very soon. The idea that it could be 500 years away, that is just absolutely false. But, of course, the idea that it could be next year is also false. And the idea that the tribulation could begin immediately, I think we've seen from all these things that have to happen even prior to the tribulation, that that's not true either. But these years go by fast. I think about my own children growing up. Annika just turned 6, and we went to a Disney thing this week. It was a lot of fun. I think about them growing up. They're growing up awfully fast. I mean, we were also looking at pictures of when she was little and when Micah was little. And 6 years goes by like that. Just really goes fast. These kids are growing up. And when you think about it in those terms, you think, well, if we've got only that many years to go, or and I'm not saying we do, but even if you want to say we've got 15 or 20 years, well, you know, that's gone by fast too. If you think about where you were 15 or 20 years ago, a lot's happened since then. There's no question. But that time has whipped by. And it's going to whip by even faster as we go further. And I don't think we have that long to wait. But let's be encouraged at the fact that these signs are around us. Not because we're happy that bad things will happen, but because, as Jesus said, when you see these things begin to happen, look up, for your redemption draws near.